Welcome to the School of Batman, a podcast where we ask academics to help Batman fight crime using their research. I'm your host, Chris George, amateur scientist and professional Batman enthusiast. On today's episode, it's the case of the self-driving Batmobile, and we're pleased to be joined by John Lees-Miller, who has a PhD in engineering mathematics from the University of Bristol. John, we'd like to start the podcast with a bit of background on yourself and your research. How did you come to engineering mathematics, and more importantly, what exactly is engineering mathematics?
Hi, Chris. That's a good question. So engineering mathematics is kind of like applied mathematics. So if you use mathematics and you apply it to engineering problems, that's engineering mathematics. So the problems that we were working on were the ones that came out of a particular application. We were working on the world's first computer-guided taxi system at Heathrow Airport. So if you ever go to Heathrow Terminal 5, you can get a driverless car to take you from the terminal out to the car park and back again. That's been going now for quite a few years, since like 2011, and it was the world's first system of its kind. So there were lots of interesting research problems that came out of that, and I did my PhD and some postdoc work on exactly those problems.
And how did you get to engineering mathematics from a kind of path from school? Were you always interested in maths, or was it more the engineering side? Where was your heart?
Yeah, I guess I got started actually on the project first. So I came over to the UK from Canada on an 18-month internship about 11 years ago now, and I've still not left. So I was already working on this project. I was originally a computer scientist, but this project actually had a lot of interesting mathematics problems. So I decided to kind of switch my focus from computing over to math stuff. And this project, I thought, had a lot of really interesting sort of problems that I could work on in that light.
And did you find there was a lot of crossover between computer science and applied mathematics, or was there a lot of kind of barrier to entry for you?
I think absolutely. Really, a lot of mathematics now is so sort of complicated that the only way you can really approach problems is computational. Mathematicians actually do a lot of computing, and so it was actually not that difficult to make the transition.
Okay, so let's dive into your story. Before we begin, we'd like to ask which Batman actor you have chosen to be your Batman.
Well, I quite enjoyed the recent Batman films, so I'm going to go with Christian Bale.
Christian Bale it is. Terror has gripped Gotham. It's New Year's Eve, and the Joker has launched a plot to release his poison into the busy streets. Batman discovers the location of the attack, a roving tanker truck with a bomb attached that will disperse into a crowd when the clock strikes midnight. Batman releases a swarm of autonomous Batmobiles, and when the Oracle discovers the location of the truck, the nearest Batmobile locks onto the tanker, hooks it, and starts to pull it into an uninhabited area. The Joker and his goons lay chase, unaware of Batman in hot pursuit in his Batbike. In the chase, some goons hijack a bus and try to blockade the Batmobile as it's full of people. But the Batmobile narrowly avoids at the last moment, unfortunately seriously injuring some well-wishers in the process. Batman finally catches up and takes down the Joker's vehicle, leaving the Batmobile to reach its destination and save the day. So I guess I'm going to start first with the thing that interests me most is some of the ethical aspects. So you have this autonomous vehicle. I think most people are at least familiar with the idea of an autonomous vehicle. But I think the ethical aspects of autonomous vehicles is something that a lot of people are interested in. There was a bus there full of people, and the Batmobile chose to make the decision not to plow into the bus, but to take an alternate path. Also, by taking that path, ended up injuring some civilians. Have you got any experience in that side of things? Like, how would the Batmobile make that decision? Is it even right to think of it as making a decision?
Yeah, definitely driverless cars introduce a lot of really interesting ethical sort of dilemmas like that one. I guess maybe I'd rewind a little bit and start up by saying that actually the Heathrow pod system that we worked on, we sort of solved this problem by going around it. The vehicles, we put them all on their own roads, so they didn't have to worry about pedestrians or other vehicles outside the system. And so we sort of sidestepped a lot of these really challenging ethical issues. But now increasingly, you know, that I guess the downside there is that you have to have your own road, which is a pretty big downside. So really the revolution in autonomous vehicles recently has been people trying to take this technology and put it out onto the roads with people wandering around and bicyclists and cars and it's a much more difficult problem, and definitely the techniques that they use are a lot more sophisticated than what we actually got working many years ago at Heathrow. So to start with the sort of ethical question, I guess you could ask, well, how would a person make that decision? And I think one of the things that makes autonomous vehicles challenging is that actually, like, we don't really know how people make those decisions. They sort of make a split second decision, and we just sort of accept that that's a hard thing to do. And there's not a lot of auditing or sort of backwards looking process that we can go through to decide whether that was the right decision or not. But at least with some types of autonomous vehicles, there would actually be a whole paper trail of exactly how the vehicle decided whether to turn and hit the pedestrians or the bus or one of the many other dilemmas it might face.
So John, when you say some vehicles would have decided, is there a distinction between how different types of autonomous vehicles can approach decision making?
Yes, there are. I mean, this is still a very sort of new field. There's a lot of research still going on. And I'd say that there are two sort of main approaches that people are looking at. So one of them is what I would call the robotics approach, where you sort of break up this very complicated problem of driving an autonomous vehicle into lots of sub-problems. And for every sub-problem, there's a system. So, you know, in your driverless vehicle, there would be a subsystem that's responsible for figuring out where the car is in the world on a map. And then there'd be another system for looking at obstacles in front of you and placing those on the map and telling you what they are, like, is that a cyclist or a car or a tree? And then those systems would then feed into as another system that does sort of path planning. And so it's this very sort of designed engineering approach that really lends itself to sort of analysis. And that's the kind of approach that the people would be able to look back and say, like, this is exactly why the car did this at this time. The other approach is a sort of newer approach, I think less well tested, but still very interesting, which is to use a different sort of artificial intelligence technique called a deep neural network. And instead of sort of decomposing the problem into lots of subproblems, deep neural networks basically work end to end. So a bit like a human sitting in the vehicle, you sort of see the road with your eyes and you decide whether to steer left or right or to press the accelerator or the brake. Basically, we just put this sort of black box called a deep neural network and we feed it your vision input and we feed it your other sort of sensor inputs, and it decides how to steer and when to accelerate and when to brake. This sort of internal structure of that black box is really very complicated. You can't really inspect it and decide how it did things. So it's much more like a person. People can't really often explain why they took a particular decision. I mean, you know, they only had a few milliseconds to make this decision and they just made one. Similarly with a deep neural network, I mean, you can ask it why it made a decision, but the answer will be something like, well, I added up this set of numbers and then I squashed them a little bit and the number, you know, the sum was less than 3. And that's why I turned left instead of right. It's not the sort of structured data that you could process. So in some ways that may change the situation a little bit with how we approach the ethics of driverless vehicles. If this technology actually takes off and is proven, deep neural networks, it would be something that we could always look back and say, well, it saw these things, but we would never actually be able to inspect exactly why it made a decision, which in some ways gets us around, in a circuitous way, around some of the more difficult ethical questions.
So many questions. With the robotics approach, that, to me, as someone who doesn't really understand it yet, would lend it to think that the designers would have to think of every eventuality before it happened. Is that a correct way of thinking? So if, for example, a giraffe was coming at you, would it matter that it was a giraffe, or would it matter that it's just an obstacle?
I'd say the individual boxes in the sort of, or the individual subsystems in this robotics approach can still be quite complicated. So there might be so complicated and also statistical. So one of the boxes might be something for classifying obstacles. That's a really good example of a problem. You'll show this system a picture of a giraffe, and it would probably not expect to see a giraffe unless maybe it was a system that had been trained in Africa to recognize things that it might see in Africa. But if you stuck a giraffe in San Francisco, I would imagine that it would probably have a hard time classifying that. So I guess it's not so much that the engineering approach forces you to anticipate every possibility, but it does at least force you to sort of handle in some explicit way all of the things that your classifier can't classify yet, or if it's too uncertain. And I guess this is a good time to talk about what you can do today already. So if you were to buy the latest Tesla, I mean, that will already have a sort of self-driving mode where you can turn it on, and it will actually be using the cameras and some other sensors like a laser rangefinder to actually navigate its surroundings. But it's going to have a sort of, you know, the way they get around this, the sort of limitations of what they can do is that basically they can cut back to you at any time. You have to be sitting there monitoring the car. And that's quite a, you know, that has a lot of consequences. So one is that, like, it's not very valuable, because if you're monitoring the car, you can't be doing other stuff that you probably want to be doing instead of doing that, like reading a book or taking a nap. Those are the sorts of things that you can't do if your car is just a self-driving car. So in the community, we often make an important distinction between a self-driving car, which is what you can buy today, and a really driverless car.
I've heard both of those terms, John, self-driving and driverless, and to me, they are interchangeable, but from what you're saying here, they're not interchangeable at all.
Yes, so there's also a feeling in the community that we could have probably picked better terms. But anyway, yes, we do draw a distinction between those two things. So self-driving is basically a car that can drive itself, but requires a driver to be present to take over in case there is something it can't handle. The car has to be able to sort of give control over to a human. Driverless is a whole different sort of game. There, you really might not have a human in the vehicle. So driverless potentially has a lot more benefit, though, because if the car never has to allow you to intervene, then you can be in the back seat having a nap or reading a book or playing on your phone. If you ever wonder why Google is into driverless cars, I think that's probably the answer. They would like you to be there Googling instead of driving your car. But it also means that you can do a lot more. So, like, most of the world's cars, if you think about it, spend like 95% of their time parked. So, you know, it's either parked outside your house, or it's parked at your office, or it's parked at the airport, or whatever. But if your car could drive itself, then there's not actually any reason for it to sit around parked. It could go off and pick someone else up. And, you know, you could also ask the question, well, do you even want to own a car if you're not the only one who can use it? It would actually make a lot more sense to have cars be more like a sort of shared resource. So that's one of the major sort of step changes that you get to by going driverless, is the cars can now basically coordinate themselves and basically just act like really cheap taxis. And, you know, if you ever wonder why Uber is interested in driverless cars, because they're one of the other major players, that's one of the reasons they're interested, is that if they can get rid of the drivers and they don't have to have drivers driving their cars, you know, that's definitely going to allow them to make a lot more money.
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge amount of sociological kind of impacts to these things that, unfortunately, we don't have time to get into today, but just you won't need car parks anymore, for example. And then there's all the kind of areas of land. But I want to take a step back, because I actually have no real idea how a driverless car even sees. I don't even know if see is the right word. How does it interact with its environment? Well, you mentioned a few systems. You said radar, stuff like that. Are there a number of different systems? Is it a case of one car has one type of system, or does a car have multiple systems for different points of failure? Do they work in concert with each other?
So I'd say it's still pretty early in the sort of development of this technology, and there are a lot of different approaches. Some people are trying to basically do this just with cameras. So, I mean, you know, it's reasonable to expect that that's possible, because we can do it, right? I mean, basically you drive by looking at the road and making sure that you don't hit things. And that's very promising, because it's potentially very low cost. but it's also very difficult. So computers are really not as good as humans yet at a lot of visual tasks. So we mentioned one already, which was object classification. Humans tend to do a lot better at object classification, so they would be much better at saying, like, that's a cyclist versus that's a tree. Although, you know, definitely technology is catching up with us in the object classification game.
So when I'm on a website, for example, and I get a capture and it's asking me to identify the street signs or the pictures of giraffes, am I effectively training a computer then to help with its machine vision?
Yes, you probably are. And if you ever wonder why the captures keep getting harder and harder, it's that the technology keeps getting better and better. And so it's becoming harder and harder to use visual tasks to sort of distinguish between people and machines. But there's still a long way to go. So most driverless cars don't just use vision. They also use other sensors. So probably the most common and the most useful sensor is what's called a LiDAR. Basically, it's a spinning laser. And if you look at one of the Google or Waymo self-driving cars, there's this sort of cylindrical thing on the top that spins. That's basically pointing a laser many, many hundreds of times per second and measuring the distance to everything that's around the car. So those LiDAR sensors are in some ways much better than any sensor that we have as humans. And any problem, you know, you can make it more difficult by using a really bad sensor, or you can make it a lot easier by using a really good sensor. So a lot of the really successful driverless cars out there today, particularly Waymo, are very reliant on the LiDAR sensor. And that allows them to get very precise information over quite a long range about everything that's in their environment. So they will be using that to get really precise, a really precise sort of 3D map of the world around them that they can then plan the vehicle's trajectory through. And they'll be using that laser rangefinder and also cameras, and they'll be doing some work to sort of fuse those two sensors together to build a really detailed map where, you know, this blob over here is a cyclist and this blob is a tree and this blob is another car.
So going back to your initial project that you did at Heathrow, you said, although it was its own roads, so you had elements of a closed system there, I imagine there were still other vehicles on that road, other self-driving vehicles, is that right?
Great, good question. So we actually controlled all of the vehicles that were on this private road, and all of those vehicles actually coordinated their movements with each other by talking to each other, basically over Wi-Fi. It was a slightly more clever Wi-Fi, but basically Wi-Fi. So they were all able to communicate with each other and decide, you know, I'm at this point in the network, so, you know, make sure you don't run into me. That's also another sort of debate in the autonomous vehicle community now, when we look at people trying to do it on the roads, is should cars actually be able to talk to each other on the roads as well. So if you imagine your car could talk to the car in front of you, and instead of sort of relying on you or indeed a very complicated sensor system in the car, seeing that, like, you had just turned on your left indicator light and you were going to turn left, you could imagine that would be a much more robust way for cars to gain an understanding of their environment based on which to make those decisions. So I guess the reason that it's kind of controversial, because it seems like a no-brainer, but the problem is really, like, how do you get started with that? And it's a simple sort of mathematical problem, I guess, is that if you manage to get, say, 10% of all vehicles able to talk to each other using some kind of standard, the odds that any two given vehicles are going to be able to talk to each other is only 10% of 10%, which is 1%. And that means that until you get to very high penetration, it's just very unlikely that your car is actually going to have anyone to talk to. So what a lot of people are doing now, and definitely like all the major players like Waymo and Uber, they are really trying to do it more like a human does. So they sort of, instead of relying on a protocol where they can ask other vehicles what they're going to do, they actually sense them. And I think they're showing that it's possible, and it doesn't have this problem with sort of penetration. There's not necessarily any issue with you being the only driverless or self-driving car on the road, although it is obviously much more challenging.
So going back to the story, Batman has a swarm of Batmobiles out in the streets. So would they be communicating with the same kind of technology you were talking about then? Because you have a direct knowledge that he would know that his Batmobiles were all on the same system and thus could all communicate together.
Yes, I think that's a good point. I think Batman would have solved this particular problem for his vehicles. And yeah, I guess it's also worth saying that we might yet get to that point where all vehicles can talk to each other, and there would actually be a lot of benefits to that happening. So, I mean, I think one of the things that happens to us all the time right now is, you know, you're driving on the motorway and all of a sudden you come to a stop and you think, oh, it's a big traffic jam, there must be like an accident or there must be some reason for this. But then you get to the end of it after a few minutes and there's nothing there. So these phantom jams happen all the time. A lot of people study these sort of phantom jam phenomena, and what they find is that actually it's mainly sort of human fallibility basically that causes these. What tends to happen is that like somebody far ahead of you on the motorway at some time, possibly quite a long time ago, pressed his brakes too hard or, you know, didn't merge very well, and the car behind him had to brake slightly harder, and the car behind her had to brake slightly harder, and so on and so forth, until basically the traffic comes to a stop. And all of that happens because, well, one, somebody didn't do a very good job, you know, they made a small mistake, nothing very serious, but that mistake was sort of magnified then by other people behind them having to take time to react to that and to brake and maybe over-braking a little bit. And so that's why we end up with this kind of wave pattern that goes backwards. But if you were a computer, I mean, one, you probably wouldn't be making those kinds of bad merges, and computers would be much better drivers, hopefully. And two, they'd all be much faster at exactly compensating for any sort of deviations that did happen. And if you can get rid of all of those phantom jams, I mean, you can actually get a lot more out of the road infrastructure, and we can all sort of get where we're going more quickly and more safely. And maybe just to pick up on an earlier point, you said that a lot of the land area is used by cars, and that's absolutely right. Particularly in North America, it's something like 1/3 of urban space is taken up by parking lots and roads. So if you can get to a world where machines are driving all the cars, even if they're just self-driving, potentially you're going to have a lot less of these sorts of problems with phantom traffic jams and other things that decrease the throughput of the road network, so you might need fewer roads for the capacity. And if you get all the way to self-driving, then potentially a lot of that space actually that's currently used for parking lots gets reclaimed, and we can start sort of re-densifying cities. And that could actually have a very far-reaching effects both on society and also on the environment. So that's very exciting.
I think it's safe to say Gotham is saved once more. Thank you to John for joining us. You can find out more about John's research on Twitter at JDLeesMiller. The link for that will be in the description. If you'd like to be a future guest on the podcast, please email us at info@figshare.com. And you can find us on Twitter at School of Batman.